Awesome. Welcome to Robots at Red Tape, everybody. A special first in-person edition. Man, really happy to have my buddy Chris Gonzalez here. Chris, if you don't mind, just tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you got here, man.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me, Nick. Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Gonzalez. I am president of AG Associates. We're a veteran-owned company, minority-owned company, focused mostly on management consulting services for the government. How I got here is quite a weird way of professional education or professional experience combined with a military background. So in, I think maybe 2000, I was at Frost Fork State University, not well known if you're outside the state of Maryland.
Yep.
I was a social science major, and I thought to myself, what am I going to do with myself? I had a child psychology class, and for extra credit, the professor was like, you can volunteer at a local elementary school and get extra credit for helping, and then kind of applying some of the child psychology things on student. You write a paper about it. So I did it. I loved it. Realized I wanted to be a teacher. So I did. I got a master's in education from Towson. I then went on to teach eighth grade social studies. And the other component of that is in 1999, when I was in Frostburg, I wanted a challenge, and I had always thought about joining the Marine Corps. So sure enough, spring break of 1999, I took the challenge. That summer, I went to boot camp and joined the reserves, not active duty, but reserves. And so since that period, I've always had these dual lives, a professional or student, and this Marine Corps background. So in my first year of teaching in 2003, I got called up to Iraq to go, you know, into the invasion of Iraq as a Marine. And then I came back and I had all of this first world experience or firsthand experience on combat and things like that, that I could apply to teaching eighth grade social studies, early U.S. history. And a big part of that was the American Revolution, you know, things that led up to that, the Civil War. So all of those things I could apply my own experience to and helping kids answer questions. And a lot of those questions were big, you know, thought-provoking questions like what would happen if the U.S. lost the Revolutionary War? Would we still be part of Great Britain today? So a lot of it was asking the right types of questions to get a good response from my audience. And then I started applying that to adult education. At the same time, I left the Marines in 2005, got back in 2010, and then went into the civil affairs field. During that period, I looked all across the different functions of what was happening in a combat zone, let's say Afghanistan, and looked at programs for public health, rule of law, economic development. And I looked at how to combine all of those things to support Marine Corps operations. So did that, started, you know, AG Associates around 2008, learned this management consulting thing based on my facilitation and education background, and put it all together to where we are now.
Awesome. And why did you decide to found AG instead of going to work for somebody else? And what, you know, in addition to that, like, what is so appealing about the this entrepreneurial life that has made you stick with it for so long, man? Because we know the heartache, right?
Yeah. Some appeal, some not so appeal. In 2008, I was sitting there having dinner with Peg Anthony, who's my business partner. And we were talking about management consulting in the government space. And she had been doing that type of work for a long time and had worked with nearly every agency and had done large-scale foundational changes in different ways of like reshaping how organizations attack these big problems. And she said, you know, a lot of what you did as a teacher and as a Marine is totally applicable to what I do. And I've built lines of businesses for big companies. And so, you know, there are contracts set aside for minority-owned businesses. There's contracts set aside for veteran-owned businesses. If you're interested in partnering up, I think we could build something together based on your background, my background, you know, our collective networks. And I thought she was nuts at the time. And a few months later, I said, screw it, let's go, let's try it.
Awesome, man. No, and that was 16, 17 years ago now.
Yeah.
That's wild. And yeah, I know you do a lot of work in the public health space, mm-hmm. VA, a lot of SAMHSA work as well. Obviously, you know, as you see, you know, obviously a lot of program management consulting. How is, you know, as you think about AI and artificial intelligence, obviously relatively young, especially in a lot of these agencies.
Sure.
How do you see it changing some of the on-project work you do? And then also, how do you see it, you know, changing your work as an entrepreneur at like a higher level?
So that's a pretty loaded question.
Always.
So, you know, I stay fairly involved in the small business community, the veteran mm-hmm. business community and stuff like that. And of course, I'm not oblivious to all of the articles that are out there about mm-hmm. AI and how it's going to change the world and how it could be used. My Marine Corps background, and, you know, when I talk to people still in the Marine Corps, some at lower levels of rank, some at higher levels of rank, I see it used in a very innovative and forward-thinking way. Mm-hmm. As we said, you know, it's about keeping up with, you know, our near-to-peer adversaries, mm-hmm. frenemies, if you will. So in that way, I see a lot of really interesting application there. Mm-hmm. On the civilian side, especially in public health agencies around Department of Health and Human Services, mostly where I work, or Department mm-hmm. of Veterans Affairs, I see it taking much, much longer. And I see AI being used probably more for compliance purposes. Mm-hmm. For instance, in Department of Health and Human Services, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, mm-hmm. SAMHSA for short, our number one client, the majority of their work is through grants. And so mm-hmm. they don't do anything. They administer grants across the country into, you know, territories of the United States. Mm-hmm. So their main thing is looking at, you know, these big problems like the 988 mental health crisis line or opioids,
right.
Affects every demographic, regardless of socioeconomic or race mm-hmm. Or location. And they're looking at how to invest in communities in a smart way, in an equitable way, and also in a way that moves the needle. But unfortunately, they spend so much of the time looking at grant applications, looking at NOFOs, basically requests for grants,
right.
Grant proposals. So much of their time is spent on compliance work mm-hmm. that it's tough to really concentrate on the content mm-hmm. that what you're trying to do and the big problem.
Right.
And looking at trends in this big problem, because mm-hmm. many of those pieces of data are old, right?
Absolutely.
Looking at suicide numbers, we're looking at 2021 numbers right now. So again, I think if we could start with looking at compliance things and having AI help to work on compliance issues, that would free up a lot of government people to think about the problem and then helping to solve the problem a little mm-hmm. bit better.
Absolutely. And I would love to talk more about why you think there's a disparity between the defense sector and civilian yeah. side, right? But I completely agree with you. I think that when you start looking at low-hanging fruit out there, right? So you think areas that either underlying technology is not good enough to do the job itself, or it can't based on processing volumes of data, you know, I think absolutely 1,000%. Things like compliance, right, where you yeah. take, you know, 200 grant applications and drop them into LLM and tell them and ask, and you can start querying them and asking yep. them and say, hey, which one of these actually meets what, you know, the which one checks all the boxes and is correct. A compliant proposal would save a lot of time. I also think that, I hosted an event last week. This isn't coming out for a few weeks, so you guys, this is a couple weeks ago for y'all. But I hosted an event last week where we had procurement people out from mm-hmm. about 5 or 6 different agencies sure. talking to small businesses, and they were doing, so we had DHS and Commerce and Energy, a few, yeah. SEC, a couple of others. And they were, one of the things that they reiterated, the CEOs, of course, reiterated, is that they spend a huge amount of time entering the same information and taking it from one yes. system to the other system to yes. the next system. So like if there's a source of sought, then there's an RFI, RFQ, then an RFP. yeah. Most of that is just copy paste, right? Mm-hmm. Most of it, you're moving the same information from one place to the other.
Sure.
but the systems are disparate and they don't talk to each other. Right. Back to bureaucracy that we think we were talking about a little earlier. And so when you know, something like that would absolutely be huge, mm-hmm. and is an area that I think, you know, AI and language models as they are now can help, as long as the underlying data infrastructure is there to support it.
Yeah.
So I completely agree, but and freeing up folks to actually do their job and think about some of these mm-hmm. issues, because like SAMHSA, right? Like, I think I've told you, I just got into the mental health space because I've lost a lot of friends to the opioid epidemic over the years. And not only have I lost friends to the opioid epidemic, I've seen people, you know, I've seen how that, you know, drug addiction can lead to other mental health disorders, and people, you know, generally don't start shooting heroin because they feel good about their life, right?
Right.
There's other things that go into that.
Sure.
So I think the mission is amazing. And so are they not running like their own IT infrastructure and everything on the back end or at SAMHSA? Or are they essentially just administering grants?
Well, think about this. SAMHSA is one administration under, I'm not sure exactly how many are under the Department of Health and Human Services, but you have Administration for Children and Families. You have Center for Medicare, Medicaid, which is the beast mm-hmm. That pays for, you know, people of certain socioeconomic categories, and for elderly people, mm-hmm. you have Center for Disease Control, mm-hmm. You have National Institute of Health, mm-hmm. You have HRSA, which is Health Resources and Services Administration. Mm-hmm. So you have all types of different organizations just under one department focusing on different issues in a different light, mm-hmm. but many of them overlap. Mm-hmm. Each of those administrations has their own set of technology, mm-hmm. their own procedures,
right.
their own grants, and their own stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So for each set of grantees under SAMHSA, they all have their own, I mean, they report with a system, I think it's called SPARS. Mm-hmm. They do the program evaluation. In fact, we do a lot of that for community-based organizations. They have a standard way of collecting it, but that's just at SAMHSA. Mm-hmm. So in the different administrations, there are all different ways of collecting information. Mm-hmm. And look at mental health, right? So SAMHSA leads the way in terms of looking at the topics at a high level and mm-hmm. then providing the grants to address those topics. But you also have the NIH looking at different, they have mm-hmm. National Institute of Mental Health is under the NIH, they mm-hmm. do research-based grants to understand the problem a little bit more. You have CDC that I know is focusing on it. Mm-hmm. And you have HRSA, which is very similar to SAMHSA, mm-hmm. looking at community-based health issues.
Right.
Mostly from a physical health point of view, mm-hmm. but obviously you can't talk about physical health without behavioral right. health and mental health. Mm-hmm. So it's all these different entities all trying to address a complex problem, but with different sets of technology, different sets of data, different lenses on the issue, and not really an integrated. There may be an integrated plan in the HHS, you know, umbrella, mm-hmm. but in terms of moving the problem forward, I don't think you could ask one person mm-hmm. in the United States, including some, you know, senior executive people, what does success look like mm-hmm. in 2 years, 5 years?
Right.
They'd all give you a different answer. They'd all define it differently. Mm-hmm. And they'd all, you know, it would be all over the place.
Absolutely. Yeah, and also CMS is another stakeholder in the mental health space. They're a big payer, right? So they're paying for a huge, huge amount of these services.
Yeah.
I know my company is 75-ish%, you know, Medicaid, because we're community mental health here in Maryland. And so back to something we touched on earlier, you know, you touched on with the disparity between civilian and defense. Why do you think that disparity exists? And is that a feature or a bug of the system?
There's probably a lot that goes into these different environments. Mm-hmm. Having worked in defense and then the civilian side, mm-hmm. the thinking is worlds apart. You know, mm-hmm. the mindset is worlds apart. There's an invisible adversary in the civilian side, again, going to public health. There's no real adversary besides time mm-hmm. or social determinants of health or other things. There's nothing tangible to label as an adversary to go mm-hmm. up against that truly pushes us to address this problem in an integrated way. Mm-hmm. In the defense side, we're obviously looking at warfighting capabilities and comparing them to other countries who are close to us with similar capabilities. Mm-hmm. So in that way, especially, you know, especially when we're looking at very advanced nations, mm-hmm. There's a need to move quicker.
Okay.
There's a need to do things more efficient. There's a need to reduce civilian mm-hmm. casualties and things like that. So in those ways, the need to move at a much different pace is sometimes dictated by us in our own government, mm-hmm. but it's also dictated by our near-to-peer adversary. And we control, you know, everything in the defense space is controlled in Department of Defense. Mm-hmm. So there can be defense-wide policy. Again, when you look at the public health mission and looking at communities, you have some that are very forward-thinking and community-based organizations that are very forward-thinking mm-hmm. and have the technology to support that. Mm-hmm. And then you have others who are still very traditional and very still trying to get their act together.
Right.
They also serve critical populations mm-hmm. And spend an enormous amount of time trying to get people in the door and service properly. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like apples and oranges to really compare the two, even though they all fall under this big mm-hmm. U.S. government umbrella.
Oh, yeah. No, understood. And that makes it makes sense that there's such a disparity, you know, in attitude before we even talk about funding, right? And then organization. Because I think there's absolutely, you know, I think the funding gap has a lot to do with it when you start mm-hmm. looking at, because, you know, anytime you start talking about deploying AI within any environment, right? If your underlying data infrastructure is set up properly, like that's a logical extension, is right. All right, now let's use the data and talk to the data. But conversely, if it's not that way, right? Which, and we all know that building and maintaining that kind of infrastructure, it takes a lot of time, man hours, and money to do so. And then I think, you know, something you touched on is lower stakes, right? It's lower stakes and, but I'd love to brainstorm how we could make it more of a competitive thing, because I think, like, when you are competing against near-peer adversaries, there's a lot of competition involved, and maybe we could bring some of that into the attitudes of the civilian side, but that also might just be my, naivety talking, so.
To totally adopt artificial intelligence, Gen AI, whatever we're going to call it, you really have to, have the infrastructure to support it, like you talked about. Mm-hmm. You have to have the policies that will allow it. Mm-hmm. Civilian side still working on the said policies. Mm-hmm. They're still concerned with things like PII and mm-hmm. medical records and you know, preventing the illegal sharing of information. That's number one. So when you're just focused on compliance, you can't take it to the next step of using it in a much bigger, smarter way. You also have you need people with the skill sets to do so and the tools to do so. So if you look at SAMHSA, you have a lot of people with behavioral health backgrounds, you have a lot of clinicians and everything, people who understand the problems very well, but you don't necessarily have a huge amount of data scientists within the organization itself that would understand how to use those tools in a way that would be able to translate to the organization, translate up to the department level, all the way up to the you know, the president, the head of the executive branch, and then translate it down to communities so communities could use it in a way that just makes sense for a limited capacity sort of way.
As you look at, you know, your projects and your programs that you're managing, are you integrating AI into them? And mm-hmm. is there an appetite or a need or desire on the government side to drive those solutions?
I think there is, probably in a smaller scale way, in a larger scale way. Mm-hmm. Like we developed a platform called Focus, mm-hmm. right? And that really helps to take high level strategic goals, break them down into initiatives, projects, and tasks, right? Mm-hmm. So high level things that are, you know, longer in nature, 3 to 5 years, mm-hmm. start breaking them down into actionable things.
Right.
That's been done before. The other component of that is looking at the data that tells the story of mm-hmm. success or not success, and being able to have visuals that help you to correlate that data. Mm-hmm. So looking at stuff like mental health services, if we have, you know, a large initiative across the country and we look at the numbers and we see that the numbers of community-based mental health clinics are going up, utilization is going up, but recidivism in terms of going back into those services or even emergency services is down, then we can tell a good story that we think those efforts are working. Right now, it would take a full agency-wide approach to really look at that and say, that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to adopt. So I think solutions are out there, like Focus, like others, that really do help organizations get to that high-level problem and then dig down deeper to tell the story of where things are working, where things aren't working. But as of now, it's going to take a lot to really get people there. In terms of the AI side of it, I think if you really, you know, Focus does not have this yet, but we are building it into there. If you start looking at high-level goals, I think there are tools in AI that could probably help dissect those goals into things like a project plan to go all the way down to a project plan. Mm-hmm. You can look at what's worked in others. You can plug it in. Mm-hmm. And then once again, it helps to make your life a lot easier. Instead of developing something from scratch, you're developing something from a template, mm-hmm. especially a template that we've known to work in other, you know, for other clients.
Yeah, and I think that those are absolutely areas that AI is great for, right? Mm-hmm. There are, and I don't, I'm can't remember the name of it. There's a to-do list creating app where you can put your high level goal in and it'll break it out into steps for you. Whether those steps are accurate or not is, you know, I can't speak for the effectiveness of it.
Sure.
I haven't used it, but I think it's great at giving you a place to start.
Yeah.
Right.
Just like writing something, right?
Oh my God. Yeah.
Writing an mm-hmm. article, brutal.
Oh yeah.
If you take some thoughts from like even like 3 a.m. thoughts that you put down on your phone.
Yep.
And you start, you know, that's when, annoyingly enough, sometimes my great ideas come to me. Mm-hmm. You write down your bullet points on your phone and then you start with those. It's a lot easier of a place to start than that blank screen.
1,000%. And that's, I mean, I use it extensively for things like that. You know, I was on a meeting yesterday. Somebody was telling me that they had used ChatGPT over the weekend to like write out all their meal plans for the week.
Yeah.
Super great. And then she said that we should, you know, create a Chrome plugin to take that ingredient list and drop it into a shopping list. Mm-hmm. And then I used ChatGPT to figure out how do you monetize a Chrome plugin, because now I'm going down a rabbit hole. Like, yeah. Can I build this? Is this something that we can do? I don't know. How would you even do that, right? But things like that where it's like it can help you figure out like a market. I've done a lot of research from a podcasting perspective about it, as I didn't know anything about podcasting when I started. I still don't know anything about it. I'm figuring it out as I go. No.
No. Maybe Joe Rogan.
Maybe. Maybe. But like I feel like, you know, he's doing a different type of program than a lot of people, other people are. He's doing something similar to this where it's interviews and conversations.
Right.
But, you know, you look at somebody like, you know, like a Dan Carlin, who's a legendary podcaster. He will read like 45 books on a history topic and then just like go into a booth and talk for hours. Right.
Yeah.
And that's a very, you know, and he's a compelling storyteller and he's just him. And I think that's a different level of effort. And I don't think that that's something that you can necessarily utilize AI to do now, especially not as effectively as somebody mm-hmm. like him can, who has 20 years of practice doing it.
Sure.
But yeah, I think lowering the barrier to entry. And then I also find that I find I'm using Google a lot less to like answer questions, because I feel like, and I forget who told this to me, but Google is like querying the internet, but like AI and generative AI is talking to the internet, right? And so
yeah, I've heard that too.
And so like it's different. And like, you know, I can go out and get seven or eight or nine different, you know, if I'm looking for a podcast hosting service, or I can get, it'll tell me, hey, here's eight of them, and this is why this one's good and bad. And but I also think that kind of usage and use case implies a level of trust in the results, which I think is only, for me, is only there because we're so early in in the process. Because I just am wondering how long is it going to be before you see a sponsored answer coming out. Because
I agree.
It's only a matter of time, right? And now it's like very pure, more so than it will be in, you know, a couple of years when they figured out how to monetize it effectively.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's going to be some that, that do that, and it's going to... I mean, like all things, unfortunately, it seems like things start well. They start with the greatest of intentions, and then they go to a certain place. Facebook was really cool when it first started. Now I stay off of it. You know, social media was that way. We talked about that earlier. I think AI will kind of head in that same direction in terms of, you know, you already see it with replacing levels of expertise to a degree, right? So you can have a law-based application that's AI. And you can get law advice from, legal advice from it. You could do the same with accounting if you really wanted to. But I do still think that only goes so far.
I agree. And I also think that it's a lot of, it's putting a lot of trust in a system that is not necessarily, that is known for being wrong, right? I don't know. I was talking to my attorney about a year ago, and he was telling me about this case that had happened up in New York where somebody, a young attorney, asked ChatGPT to write them a law brief, and it looked great. The problem was that all of the case law that it was referencing was all made up.
Oh, wow.
All of it, right?
Yeah.
And then he, the same attorney, did it again, right? A second time. I used ChatGPT to write a response, and it was, you know, all the case law was made up. And that will get better with time, but I certainly won't use it to write a contract for me.
Right? And that's reasons like that is why I think it will take the federal government, again, on the civilian side, so much more time to truly adapt it, because it has to become something proven for them to adapt it, because they can't, the risks for adapting something that doesn't work, and then obviously the press behind it, since we're all paying the bill for this, it's pretty high. So I got to understand the risk tolerance on the government side too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw, I mean, that I mean, like you said, just reminded me of something. I was watching an interview with some folks about NASA talking about SpaceX, right? And, you know, and there were former flight engineers and like directors at NASA that were, you know, saying that if we had accidents at the same rate that SpaceX did, we would have been in front of Congress and called up, and there you go, and we could have potentially had charges against us. You don't know, because the risk tolerance is so much lower. And I think that's a double-edged sword sometimes, right? It's both an upside of, hey, you know, we're trying to be safe and being careful, but at the same time, like, you need to balance that with the need to innovate. And something like space shouldn't necessarily be controlled by a private corporation. When you look at, like, that should, I mean, I'm not saying it should be 100% government controlled either. I'm not an expert. I'm not sure what the right balance is, but there's something to be said there, that the government should be able to put their own astronauts into space and get people to and from the space station. Because when things break, I think, don't we have astronauts up there, up in the space station right now, just kind of waiting until February when they can get brought down again, maybe? Like, it's wild. But yeah, man, how do you, you know, as you think about your military background, and how is that experience, you know, influenced your leadership style, working in a civilian world and working with managing folks that are let's just say sensitive as they are in the mental health space? Because I do the same thing. So how has that worked?
Well, I've been trying to translate my military experience here to civilian side for quite some time, and I do think that being in the reserves was actually a benefit, because Many times I'll tell people I'm bilingual. I could speak Marine, and I can get in that mode pretty quickly to where I'm extremely direct and to the point. And then, you know, sometimes I need to turn that off. And then other times I can look at the civilians and some of the people that I deal with who aren't used to that real direct nature of communication. And I have to think to myself, what will the most effective way of communicating be? So I think in terms of leadership lessons, there's two tenets in the Marine Corps that are essential. And those two things are mission accomplishment and troop welfare. And a leader should not be comfortable unless they're focusing on those two things and juggling those two things. And unfortunately, mission accomplishment and personnel welfare don't always go hand in hand. Sometimes when you have to, you know, make layoffs, sometimes we have to release people, sometimes when you have to correct people's behavior and everything like that, it becomes challenging. And so I think from the behavior point of view, I think the one thing that I take away is modeling the behavior that I'm looking for. And being explicit about what I'm looking for instead of implicit, saying, you know, if I want someone to write a good email, I say, address your audience, give me the context, and then end the email with a specific ask and a date to which that ask is completed. You know, not just saying, yeah, reply, you know, or send an email, but real life instructions. Then taking those instructions and doing them myself all of the time and trying to show people this is the communication style that works for me. The style may not necessarily work for you, but if we're both working on the same sheet of music of certain communication agreements, then I think we're doing it better. Absolutely. Right? So again, modeling, being specific instead of just, you know, implying that I'm looking for something.
Right.
Sometimes I just don't see it in the civilian side today. People are a bit timid about asking for what they are looking for. And then I think sometimes people aren't always comfortable saying, I'm not sure what I'm asking for. Or I'm not sure what, if you do this for me, I'm not sure what that looks like. So if that's the case, then just tell the person who's doing something for you, I don't have any clue what this looks like.
Absolutely.
But let's check in October 15th and see what you got and then, you know, go from there.
Yeah.
It's admitting your own faults, admitting your own like lack knowledge gaps. I think it's just tough to do these days.
Yeah.
You know?
It is. I also find that, you know, I think that like that's how I communicate as well. Is very very, very, I guess honest is the right word I'm looking for. I'm not trying to bullshit anybody, right? Like, I'll tell you specifically if I can do something, if I can't, I'll tell you why. And if I can't, or if I don't know, I'll tell you, I'll go find out, right? Yeah. And that's, and I think what I found is that reiterating to people that I don't know is a better answer than yes or I know.
Yeah.
And you have no idea. Like, let's all get on the same page about what we know, what we don't know, and be super clear and super upfront about, and super honest and authentic about where we are. It's, you know, you can't, if you say yes all the time and I know all the time, if you don't, you're not giving yourself as a receiver of knowledge the opportunity to learn and grow. Yeah. You're limiting yourself, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's super interesting, and I, you know, balancing the two tenets of the Marine Corps from both the you know, welfare and mission accomplished. I'm not sure how do you balance those things in you know, like in a combat zone where mission accomplished might be directly detrimental to troop welfare.
I think it kind of goes back to what we were talking about and being upfront. You know, Marines especially, and you know, I look at the different leadership styles of the different branches, and I've talked to friends of mine, but of course mine will always default back to Marine Corps because that's what I know firsthand. Looking at really combat-related situations, sticky situations, Iraq was a very good example of that. When we went into Iraq in 2003, nobody knew what to expect. Mm-hmm. Not one person, if anyone did say they did, they knew what to expect, they were lying. You might have had a couple people in the unit who had served in Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, all the movies you saw were like in Vietnam, mm-hmm. right? You saw heavy combat and everything is
right.
sensationalized. And mm-hmm. so, you know, every single mission we had to prepare for not coming back. Mm-hmm. We had to prepare that our good friend to our right, to our left, was not going to make it back. Mm-hmm. So I think the honesty of the current situation or of the situation that your team is walking into has to be an essential part of troop welfare, of taking care of your people. Mm-hmm. If you don't prepare them mentally for what they're going to walk into, that applies to business as well. 100%. You know, I've walked into strategic planning engagements mm-hmm. and people were really annoyed, right? And I didn't know because I'm in there with the best of intentions trying to mm-hmm. develop a 3 to 5 year plan for an organization.
Right.
And they're like, little did I know that their leader was new. Mm-hmm. And they told their leader they already had an existing plan, mm-hmm. but he came in there and he wanted his own. And so right. now they're going back to the drawing board, even though they had a great framework before. Mm-hmm. So it's just like making sure that you're upfront about the realities of a project, a challenge or whatever. That leads to taking care of your people. Because if you know the problem and the problem set, then you can not only think about solutions, but also taking care of each other mm-hmm. in the roles in that solution.
From a leadership perspective, obviously I can't relate to the combat piece and military service sure. piece, but from a leadership perspective, 1,000%. I personally always view my role as to set my people up for success
sure.
and to clear obstacles out of their way that they can't be expected to clear on their own, but at the right. same time, coaching them and mentoring them and teaching them how to do it themselves.
Sure.
And that's a hard balance to walk, right? Especially when you're dealing across multiple organizations with multiple people and a yeah. lot of different personalities. And I mean, I'm dealing across multiple different businesses, not sure. business line, like multiple businesses. And,
yeah.
you know, government consulting and government contracting is very different from a mentality perspective than mental health. And that's very different from like technology. And so, sure. you know, understanding your audience and who you're speaking to, I think is one of the most important things because
sure.
it doesn't matter how good your message is if it's not being received.
I agree. But the same goes for, you know, your mental health clinic, mm-hmm. right? Serving people at the community level is a very honorable thing. It's a great thing. But in all honesty, every now and then it could turn bad,
mm-hmm.
right? 100%. And if the people that you have on your team don't understand the protocol of if this turns bad, here's what you do, you're not doing them a service as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's worst case scenario,
mm-hmm.
not preparing for a situation if it turns violent or something like that is not taking care of your people. You know what I mean? So again, thinking about best case scenario, worst case scenario, plans for that, and just understanding all of what you may be walking into helps the person to be, you know, confident in what they're doing, to focus on the things they do well,
mm-hmm.
but understanding the support system if they don't.
Yeah, absolutely. Completely agree. And you know, over the last... As you gain more success and more,
yep.
More success and more experience throughout throughout your career, what are ways that you focus on giving back and mentoring folks, whether it's, you know, peers within the entrepreneur community, mm-hmm. veteran community, Latino community, and how do you prioritize your time?
Well, time is the enemy. If we talk about an
Always.
Adversary, time is that adversary for me. I'm sure you feel the same.
Oh my God, man. Yeah. I it's funny. I always am shocked when it's like 3 o'clock and I'm sending
yeah.
emails saying good morning because I feel like it should be 10:30.
Like yeah.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm always looking at ways to make things a win-win. Mm-hmm. Right. So I enjoy speaking at the project management community. I enjoy speaking in the veteran business community. Mm-hmm. I enjoy speaking to veterans. And so, you know, my ability to help them, of course, is limited by the amount of time that I have. But if I invest an hour or two meeting with someone who's thinking about coming out of the military and starting a business, that also might mean I found the next partner, business partner, who has complementary capabilities, skill sets, and all that good stuff. If I, you know, have someone who's trying to, who's thinking about starting a community-based organization, at some point, you know, they may reach back to AG and say, you know, we need some help with the infrastructure building stuff. So I always like to think that even though I might not see it immediately, I think karma is a big thing. And the karma, the concept of a karma bank account definitely works. But I also think that there are tangible business benefits that come back to you, not immediately, but down the line, the more that you do to make yourself available, the more that people remember that, and that comes back to you in the form of business somehow.
Yeah, I 1,000% agree. I personally will take meetings, and I'm not sure why I'm taking the meeting sometimes. I'll do it like I you know, I have a call later. I don't know why I'm talking to this woman. I reached out to her about working with her, and then she was like, yeah, I need a job. And I'm like, I don't know what we're going to talk about or where this is going to go, you know, but like you just never know how these things are going to move and how it's going to work. And I also, I believe in planting seeds, right? Like on that, like, what are some of the big, somebody comes to you and says, Chris, I'm thinking about starting a business. What are some of the things and the lessons that you tell them and the advice that you give them?
I'd say that most people, when they think about starting a business, doesn't matter what stage you are in life, what your background is, they think about it mostly because they are good at either a service or developing a product. That's usually the number one thing that I see from people. Great, that's definitely critical. The second piece that sometimes is thought about, sometimes not, is the market and understanding the market. A lot of people have great ideas, but if the market's, like, if the product is there and it's a really popular product, and you don't have a machine behind you, like if you come up with an alternative to Microsoft Office, and it's just you self-funding this, good luck to you, right? So it's understanding the ability to market your product, buy, you know, have people buy it, simplicity of buying it, what the marketplace looks like, who your competitors, really thoroughly understanding that versus just saying, oh yeah, I think there's a market out there for people and I see it being sold for 10 bucks, so I'm gonna sell for 10 bucks. It's much more difficult than that. So again, service and product, that's one part. The marketing and the market analysis is the second part. And the third part, which I think very few people think about, is what do I do when I find success? Right? Scaling up. Infrastructure. If I get that big 10-person, 50-person contract, what then? If I'm selling a product and I get into Walmart, what then? Walmart, by the way, does a ton of mentoring veteran-owned businesses. They almost do like a mentor-protege relationship to get them ready to scale before they get in stores. So it's stuff like that, like thinking of distribution. In the services side, how do you price it? Right? Most people think to themselves, oh, I make X amount per year. I want to make X amount per year. Divide that by 2,000-ish hours, and that's how much I charge per hour. Well, that's fine if it's just going to be you taking care of you. But that doesn't account for a ton of other things. And then once it's more than just you, then what do you account for? So it's understanding what success looks like and what are the components that go into success when it's not just you, or it's not just you and three others that are sitting in a room doing stuff together. And we're at that point in our company now where we've grown pretty significantly. It's been a great growth period, which is fun and exciting and, you know, humbling. But we've learned a lot of lessons along the way. And we have teams of people that are doing the right things. Mm-hmm. It's just happening so fast that, you know, I think we're ready for it. But mm-hmm. in any case, you always have some lessons learned for how you could do it different.
1,000%. Yeah, and if there aren't lessons learned, then you're not paying attention to the right stuff,
exactly.
Right?
And you're not being honest.
Absolutely. And I think it's fat. Like, I agree from a scale perspective, right? Because obviously with my, you know, one of my companies being in the staffing space and also working as a sub and helping to bridge that gap for folks, I've talked to countless people where it's like, I just want a 8, 9, 10 person contract, and I don't know how I'm going to provide these people, right? Yeah. You can call your friends and get some referrals, but that's only going to get you so far. How do you make sure that you're delivering, right? Yeah. Or if, you know, Walmart comes and instead of ordering 1,000 widgets of whatever, they want 100,000.
Yeah.
How are you even going to begin to deliver that order? And right. What kind of time is that going to take?
Yeah.
I always ask people when they talk to me about this, like, why are you doing this? Like, yeah. What's your why here?
Yeah.
Why are you going to, because it's easier to go get a job.
Yeah.
And it people feel like it's more secure, but you and I both know with at-will employment, it's not so secure.
Yeah.
But like, because if anytime somebody tells me that I want to do it for the freedom and the lifestyle, or I want to do it because I want to make money.
Yeah, good luck.
Like, dude, that's absolutely wrong. 1,000%. Yeah. Like, money is a result, and freedom is something you might be able to earn one day, maybe. Maybe,
right.
But like at the end of the day, and I know you get these calls, like you get calls at 9 o'clock at night because sure. something's going on, or, you know, on like the mental health side, like, you know, we had, like at one point there was a clinician there where there were allegations of professional misconduct right. by somebody, right? I'm the one that gets the call at 6 o'clock in the morning to talk yeah. about this. I'm the one on the meetings all day, and yeah. I'm the one interacting with the attorney and figuring out how do we go about rectifying this situation, mm-hmm. right? And how do we rectify the situation for the client who's making the allegation, right? How do we mitigate liability against us as an organization sure. to make sure we're doing the right things? And then how do we work with the licensing board to make sure that we're reporting the right things?
Yeah.
Right. And like, that's just something that happened like 18 months ago over a couple of days. Right. A friend of mine is starting he's starting a business now. He just got on his first subcontract. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he's like, he reached out like, hey man, do you have business insurance guy? Like, yeah, dude, you don't have business insurance.
Right.
Like, you've been operating for right. like, you don't have revenue, but you've been operating for 9 months. Like, how do you not have insurance? But like and then it's also like the number of skill sets and the number of things you need to yeah. do as a business owner is astounding, right?
Yeah.
None of my businesses are as big as yours, right? But like, you know, some of them I'm still like managing finances, looking at sure. bookkeeping, managing cash flow, right? Looking at deliverables, managing clients, managing and like that's just yeah. before 9:30 every day, right? Yeah. Like, and so I always personally tell people, like, I love what you said. I'm just trying to understand why people are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
What are they trying to get out of it, and what's their goal first?
Yeah.
And then I also impress upon them the difficulty of it, because it's the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And how, and I, you know, and the difficulty of it, and the number of skill sets and the infrastructure that you need.
Sure.
Because it takes everything to get your business around a corner where you're not driving everything. And yeah. so it's, yeah, man, it's fascinating.
What's funny, you know, the other piece of advice I think I give budding entrepreneurs is looking at the balance of people and technology,
mm-hmm.
right? You can purchase accounting software.
Mm-hmm.
You could figure out how to use the accounting software. That will never, in my opinion, replace a good accountant. It will never replace someone who thinks with numbers all of the time. It thinks with mm-hmm. In that way and with a very analytical mind.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? It will never, you know, getting the on the demand legal services
mm-hmm.
will never replace like the role of a good lawyer and making mm-hmm. sure like you're not just out of trouble now, but in the future.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's stuff like that. It's figuring out which which things enable your business in terms of like saving you time that are technology based and, you know, potentially AI based now that we get into this era of AI.
Yep.
But which people will be game changers in your organization? And do you hire those people to be part of the internal team or do you outsource? There's an argument for all of it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it comes down to subjective decisions, right? Yeah. In a specific situation. And then, you know, one of the things that I have been doing over the last 18 months, almost 2 years now, is it's a routine inspection of my day-to-day tasks, right? And asking myself, should I be doing this or should somebody else be doing this?
Right.
And how do I protect my time to make sure that I am doing things that nobody else can bring to the table?
Yeah.
Because there's stuff at AG, there's stuff at, you know, Healing My Wellness, at Artemis, at these other organizations I have going on that there's stuff that nobody else can do, right? Like I should, like, you know, high level interacting with clients, things like that. Absolutely. But like, you know, day-to-day management of questions, like, no, you go take care of that. I don't need to be this involved right now. And,
sure.
And how do I mitigate the amount of time that I'm spending doing administrative stuff and doing things that are not adding huge amounts of value?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I agree.
And so
it's a tough juggle.
Dude, is it ever? It's so much fun though.
Yeah.
And like, and when I'm talking to entrepreneurs, I tell them, and I'm super upfront about, or, you know, entrepreneurs, whatever you want to call them,
sure,
tell them constantly, like, listen, I will tell you all the bad things that go on. I'll tell you about the times that clients decided not to pay for 90 days and they was due net 30 and it's 90 days and I'm having to run around to make sure that I can cover payroll that's coming out of the account on Thursday and it's Tuesday and I'm like $9,000 short, right? Like, that's on me, right? I'm the one that needs to solve that problem. And people don't have these conversations. And I go through all that and I tell them all of that. And I'm like, you know, listen, I wouldn't do anything else. I would never anything else. I love this. I love how dynamic it is. I love how you get to go in and like actually do the cool stuff. And like, you know, I there's nothing else I would rather do.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you know, I believe one of the best parts of starting your own company is being able to shape it around your own values, right? For me, mine is along the lines of just creating an environment where everyone can thrive. I don't care what you look like. I don't care where you come from. I don't care what your political or religious ideology are. As long as you share, like, as long as you share the values that I do with hard work, dedication to customers, collaboration, you know, potentially doing things for others who are less fortunate than yourself. I don't care what your background is, nor do I really care what mistakes you made in life. So I think that those types of things and the come as you are type attitude, I've always valued that because I got friends that are all over the place in every type of way. And I think that kind of the diversity of AG is one of our superpowers because we bring the diversity of thought, the diversity of backgrounds, the diversity of everything. And we're looking at big problems, complex problems. So if we're looking at those things, of course we should have different ways of looking at life. Of course we should have representation from different, you know, different groups that are representing the country. Of course we should have that stuff so we're doing it right and not one-sided. And I think that, you know, when you value that type of stuff and you could care less about all the other noise that sometimes the media likes to focus on, I think people just like that environment. They feel like they can thrive and you just be yourself, you know, share some commonality, share a few differences, and but, you know, really have fun with each other.
1,000%. I've always, if you're having fun while you're working and doing good things,
it makes a huge difference.
Huge difference. Yep. And that difference gets translated into your work product. It gets translated to your deliverables. It gets translated to your clients. Your clients will want to work with you more. I 1,000% agree with you. I also believe I'm with you. And like, I think I've told you, like, my hiring rule, and with, like, I've hired a lot of people for a lot of people, right? Over 15 years. My rule is and always has been, I call it the 10-40-50 rule. I think anytime you hire somebody, 10% will be based on things like education and certifications, right? hiring a therapist, do they need, where do they need to be licensed? Those things are like pass fail. You got to be it, right? Hiring an accountant, do they need to be a CPA? Only 40% is going to be your hands-on experience and what got you there. And the other half is, that's the important part. It's the
intangibles.
Right? Intangibles is personality fit. It's corporate culture fit. It's, are you going to show up early and stay late? Does this matter to you? Are you going to show up to events with me and like go out and hobnob? Or are you, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Do you care, or are you just here for a paycheck? And I will work with people that have the right intangibles, and I will work with them all day, and I will train them and teach them instead of hiring people that have a huge amount of experience but aren't necessarily the right people.
I agree.
And then it's all, how do you foster that in an organization? And then also how do you empower folks? Like, I want people that work for me.
Yeah.
Like, obviously they're not going to work for me forever, right?
Sure.
When they move on, I want to have accelerated them from a professional perspective.
Yeah.
Because I think that folks like you and I have a very different perspective and vantage point on how business actually works and operates, as opposed to people that have only ever been an employee, but also who have only ever worked for, you know, mid-size or large organizations.
Yes, yes.
It's such a different world.
Hugely different. You see that? I mean, that's what my business partner, Peg, she worked for big companies. She had, you know, these capabilities that she could draw on. And then when we had to find our own, like pricing or, you know, HR, things like that. When you have to find your own, it's a big difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it's not like, you know, oh, you know, to pricing, like, oh yeah, no, I do the Excel sheet, but like, there's somebody else that writes the cost volume. Like, yeah that's great, but like, here, you got to do it, right? Like, you just got to deliver, and it needs to be compliant, it needs to tell a good story.
Sure.
And it also, like, the numbers need to work, right? And there's no stopgap, there's nothing. It's either we're going to get this done, or we're just not going to have more business coming in.
Yeah, agreed.
So what do you see as the future role of AI moving in both government and private sector consulting?
Sure. I'm not sure in the private sector. I mean, of course, there are going to be AI solutions that make your company more predictive, more efficient, things like that. Some companies are going to embrace them. Some companies are going to say, that's not for me. We'll see. I mean, I guess time will only tell what happens to professions in the future and if those professions ever get replaced. Mm-hmm. But in the government space, I do see that very first step really focusing on AI replacing a lot of the compliance things that people spend so much time on, potentially bridging the gap between different systems that are out there. And being able to help organizations, at least my hope would be to help organizations collaborate in one space with the same information. Still understanding they're all looking at solutions differently, but the same sheet of music for what current state looks like and the same agreements for what desired state could be and how that's measured. And then you can go about execution in the ways that you've done before, again, with a little more, less focus on compliance, more on doing the work, but really thinking through, what are we trying to achieve as a country? How do we measure it? How do we make sure that we bring people along while we're doing it?
Absolutely, man. Completely. I love it. I think that's a absolutely a logical extension. I use AI largely for administrative tasks, right?
Yeah.
And if you can reduce that and increase the amount of time that your people, and for me personally, the amount of time that I have to do the, again, work that I have to do, as opposed to the, like, writing or things, you know, get me 80% of the way there, I'll work through the rest.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, man, this is awesome. Dude, before we wrap up, Chris, anything else you want to add, say, anything at all, man?
No, I think that's it, man. I really appreciate you having me.
Dude, I appreciate you, man. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you for coming on Robots and Red Tape, man. I appreciate you, brother.
You're welcome.
Thank you.